This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. For years, America's security and defense chiefs have warned that a major terror attack is inevitable, and the next one may well come online. There have been big cyber attacks in recent years, but which one do you think has made the biggest difference? Was it the Iranian cyber attack against a dam in New York 2 years ago? Here's what Preet Bharara, the former U.S. attorney based in Manhattan, said back in 2016.
We now live in a world where a devastating attack on our financial system, our infrastructure, and our way of life can be launched from anywhere in the world.
Maybe it was when China hacked the federal government's HR department, the Office of Personnel Management. That attack compromised the private information of 21 million government workers and their spouses and close relatives. Republican Congressman Michael McCaul of Texas chairs the House Homeland Security Committee. Here's what he told CBS News in 2015.
This was the most significant breach of federal networks in U.S. history. In my judgment, this was an attack by China against the United States government. It quantifies to espionage, and that raises all sorts of issues that we need to deal with.
And of course, there's Russia. It's clear now that Vladimir Putin tried to disrupt and interfere with the 2016 election. Surely that stands out as our biggest cyber attack? Before leaving office, President Obama stressed the need for action.
As a consequence, it is important for us to review all elements of that and make sure that we are preventing that kind of interference through cyber attacks in the future.
Now, those were all big, but our guest today says we learned the most from an attack involving a movie.
The CIA would love it if you could take him out.
Hmm?
Take him out.
Like for drinks?
Like to dinner?
Take him out of the town?
No, take him out.
You want us to kill the leader of North Korea?
Yes.
The Interview was a comedy about a plot to assassinate North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. Hackers demanded that the film not be released. And when Sony Pictures released it online anyway, it suffered a devastating attack, crippling systems and leaking internal documents. Our guest says the Sony hack probably did more to improve the government's cyber capabilities than anything in the last decade. John Carlin is the author of The Code War, America's Battle Against Russia, China, and the Rising Global Cyber Threat. John, welcome to 1A.
Thanks, Joshua.
So remind us about the Sony hack, first of all, if I left anything out, and then why you think it was so very significant.
Well, having worked on all of those incidents when I was inside government, I can tell you, in a long career, including as chief of staff to the director of the FBI, Bob Mueller, as head of the National Security Division, never did I imagine that there'd be an instance where I went into the Situation Room, sat down to brief the National Security Council and the President of the United States, and had to start with a plot summary about a bunch of pot smokers. It was quite a surprise. You know, we spent years thinking about what will it look like if a rogue nuclear-armed nation decides to attack the United States through cyber means. And we all thought it would be something with the electric grid or the financial sector. But the first two attacks, there actually was one before Sony that hit a bunch of casinos, the Sands casinos that was linked to Iranian-affiliated actors, turned the computers into bricks, and it's because they didn't like something that the head of Sands Casino said.
And when you say turn the computers into bricks, you mean rendered them basically inoperable. Couldn't turn on, couldn't function, nothing.
Exactly. Just imagine you get a blank screen when you try to boot up your computer, turn your computer on. What's interesting about Sony, and a lesson that we still need to keep learning, is that the reason why everyone remembers Sony is not because it was a destructive attack. It was, just like the Sands Casino attack, which people do not remember, it turned Sony's computers into bricks. But number two, just like we had seen China do on an epic scale, billions of dollars worth of intellectual property, they also stole intellectual property, the North Koreans, from Sony and released it. That's not why people remember Sony. When you think about it, what people remembered about Sony and why it was having such an impact at the time was because of the internal email traffic, the salacious emails that were embarrassing to the brand. And those were released using third parties, using social media. Then they were picked up by the mainstream media. And ironically, the mainstream media did most of the damage to Sony on behalf of North Korea, who is trying to chill free expression, free speech. It's one of the key lessons, that weaponizing of information that we were then to see again the Russians use with our election.
What could have been done differently in the Sony hack?
Well, there's a couple of things or lessons that we learned, or businesses and consumers that we talk through in the book. And one of it, and I'm so glad you're covering the subject today, is that I'm not sure so much of what people think is science fiction has already happened. We already are in a code war. And one of the reasons we started bringing criminal cases and bringing it into the public was so people would see what the tactics were that bad guys, nation states, terrorists, and criminals were using. And once you understand them, you can better protect yourself. So one thing Sony did absolutely right is they knew who to call in government. That's why we were able to respond and treat it like a national security event. I often get asked, well, why did you treat it like a national security event? It's about a movie, and you had that good clip there to show it was a pretty silly movie. One of the reasons why we treated it like a national security event that I think was right is a lesson that we're still learning and improving on is we designed a lot of our architecture, a lot of the processes to protect us from cyber attacks around stuff, electric grid, water, financial sector. What we didn't think about as much is attacks on our values. The North Korean attack on Sony was really about an attack on a fundamental American value, that of free expression. And if we didn't respond in kind with sufficient strength from government, then we're sending a message not just to North Korea, but other countries around the world, that you can interfere with core American values from abroad. You can chill free speech and get away with it scot-free. So some things I think we did right was in 28 days, we figured out who did it, publicly said who did it, and then did sanctions. Things we could improve on are, number one, increasing, which we talk about some in the book, we've gotten better at over time, increasing the retribution, increasing the cost that we impose on adversaries. And number two, thinking more creatively about what constitutes an attack, a core attack on America. You know, fast forward to the Russian elections, the president had signed and put in place for the first time in our history an executive order that allowed you to sanction other countries, individuals, or companies because of cyber attacks, just like we do with terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. The first time we ever used it was against the Russians for the attack on our elections. It was too late because it was in December, I think, to cause maximum deterrence. But also, we had to rewrite the executive order because it didn't include, it thought about attacks on infrastructure, but it didn't include something like an attack on our democracy.
Well, and I hear you in terms of exploiting our values, this attack on our democracy. I wonder if you think there was some extent to which, you know, because of the nature of the attack, parts of the press ended up being complicit with the hackers. I mean, as you said, the Sony Pictures hack made so much news because of those internal emails among executives at Sony that said things about how they dealt with certain actors and basically privileged professional communications. And I am sure that there were plenty of news organizations, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, maybe even TMZ, who said, well, if we don't run this, someone else is gonna.
That's exactly right. And I think one thing you're seeing now is as we share these stories about what bad guys are doing, how they're doing it, that we're having important conversations like in the media of what is the role of the media. If you know you're aiding and abetting and facilitating a foreign power that's attacking everything that it is that allows us to have a free press, can that change your coverage? Can you at least give a lot of context before you just do the damage of releasing, even if it's fun news for a day, releasing this type of information when it's part of a campaign against the media or against democracy? The other thing that companies can learn from, and we've been advising on, and even individuals, is a great lesson from Macron's campaign in France.
Emmanuel Macron, the president of France.
Yes. So his campaign looked at what happened inside the United States, and they knew that Russia was not a fan of his campaign when he was running. And so they thought, well, we're going to be targeted. What should we do? And what they did was they deliberately put false emails, so fake information, inside their system. So when Russia predictably attacked their campaign and stole the email traffic and then released it to the media, the campaign said, hey, some of this stuff is real and some of it isn't. We're not going to tell you which is which. That caused the media to be very cautious. He was able to successfully win the campaign, and it muted a lot of the damage. And that comes from a change in mindset.
Where, that's like lining a bank vault with counterfeit bills.
Exactly, exactly. See, nowadays, unlike a bank vault, there is no internet-connected system, unfortunately. The technology doesn't exist that's safe from a dedicated adversary, a nation state or organized criminal group that wants to get in. And some of the stories that I tell in the book are about how once you recognize that mindset, there are steps you can take. So for instance, you know, don't put your crown jewels in a folder called crown jewels if you know that a bad guy can get in, right? Put stuff that doesn't work. We've had companies creatively put in designs so that the bad guy who steals it, thinking they're going to get an advantage on research and development, spends millions of dollars and years building something that won't work.
I wonder how we apply that to everyday people, though, and I do want to talk to you more about that as we continue our conversation with John Carlin. Glad to get some of your emails and comments in as well. Sid writes, I serve as a volunteer with the National Initiative for Cybersecurity Education. Today, cyber criminals are targeting soft targets, utilities, schools, hospitals, etc. They're well-motivated, sophisticated, well-funded, and face no real consequences. Unfortunately, organizations and individuals aren't well-motivated, sophisticated, or well-funded. We got addicted to technology without realizing the hidden cost of keeping it secure. I'd love to get your thoughts on that when we continue with John Carlin, author of the new book, The Code War. Later on, we'll also hear what Facebook is doing to go after bad actors online and how it's fighting back against terrorists. Probably one of the most common areas in which you and I could be exposed to this kind of threat. What can we do to protect ourselves, if anything? I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the evolving war against cyber attackers with John Carlin, former Assistant Attorney General for National Security at the Department of Justice. His new book is called Dawn of the Code War. We'd love to hear from you, too, especially if you are involved in cybersecurity. What are you seeing in terms of the emerging threats and how well we're able to deal with them? Or for that matter, have you been targeted yourself? If you're willing to talk about what happened and what you learned from it, we'd love to hear from you. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. John, looking at all of the hacks that we know about, the one from the Office of Personnel Management, Facebook, that big hack at the credit reporting firm Equifax, we're talking about many, many, many millions of accounts. Should we just assume that we've been picked off at some point? I mean, sometimes I feel so personally foolish for having lived my life online without worry before I became the host of this program. I just, not even vulnerable, but just foolish, like to not be more thoughtful about the fact that sooner or later my personal information is going to get picked off. Is that a reasonable feeling?
You know, you hope that people don't feel foolish, but it is true. And one of your earlier guests commented on it, which is we don't do enough to educate on it. You know, my girl's in school now, and they don't have a standard course in the public school system on basic cybersecurity. And unfortunately, you need it right now. It's not a safe space. And part of learning how to make it safe is educating people both at the consumer level. And one of the things talk about in the book is even at our most sophisticated institutions, let's say MIT, learning cybersecurity, unlike how to code, was not part of the basic curriculum. So even at the highest levels, people weren't thinking about this day to day. I hope that there's time for a change and that it doesn't depend on just your behavior, Joshua, which is, you know, when I grew up in New York in the 80s, it used to be if you made eye contact with someone, you know, if you didn't cross the street when you saw someone, then it was your fault if you got stabbed. There's a famous Saturday Night Live skit that's like, what, did you make eye contact? What do you expect?
Yeah,
of course you get stabbed. That's
kind
of today on the internet, right? Like if you don't change your alphanumeric 30-character password every 30 days for the 25 different accounts you have, that it's your fault as a consumer. I don't think we're ever going to get out of it if that's our mindset. What we need to do is focus on technology that makes it easier for consumers to use, and also recognize there's maybe some stuff we just shouldn't be doing using a protocol that's fundamentally not secure.
I do think that we are having a slightly more sophisticated conversation these days. I mean, even that meeting that Kanye West had with President Trump in the Oval Office, there was that shot of him sitting at the Resolute desk opening his phone, and his password was 00000, which, for those of you playing the home game, is a really bad password. Can we pick apart what you're referring to as the code war? You say that it bears some resemblance to the Cold War. In what ways?
I think we're in for a generational struggle, and that struggle is going to include not just the use of force, but the setting whose values prevail, whose norms prevail about the world that we want to live in. And then you need to execute on those values with your tactics. So do deterrent, bring criminal cases, make public behavior that you think is unacceptable, like the Russian malware NotPetya that indiscriminately hit companies around the world, like Maersk Shipping, FedEx, hospitals, and took them offline. I think we can partner with countries that share our values around the world, work together to collectively impose a cost on a rogue actor like Russia when they do that type of activity to say, this is unacceptable. It's not going to change overnight, though, just like the Cold War. It's going to take years and years and years of day in, day out fighting. And this war has already begun. And part of what I was telling are stories that we didn't used to tell, that we kept secret inside government, but now we're trying to make public, I think importantly, so that consumers, so that companies can realize that we're already in this conflict and start taking steps to be a part of it.
You quote your old boss early in the book. Here's part of what Bob Mueller said in a speech you worked on back in 2007. It's a fairly long quote, but I want to read it in its entirety. Here's part of what Bob Mueller said at the time. Quote, "There's an old saying that all roads lead to Rome. In the days of the Roman Empire, roads radiated out from the capital city, spanning more than 52,000 miles. The Romans built these roads to access the vast areas they had conquered. But in the end, these same roads led to Rome's downfall, for they allowed the invaders to march right up to the city's gates." He goes on to say, quote, "The internet has opened up thousands of new roads for each of us, new ideas and information, new sights and sounds, new people and places. But the invaders, those whose intent is not enlightenment, but exploitation and extremism, are marching right down those same roads to attack us in multiple ways," unquote. Is this another Roman moment? Are we kind of becoming a victim of our openness?
I think it could be if we don't realize the moment that we're in. I remember vividly when Director Mueller gave that speech. We were out in the Pennsylvania area. It was the first major speech on cyber as a national security threat. Think about that. It's now considered by the Director of National Intelligence, all the major officials, to be the top threat. It was only around 10 years ago that we even talked about it seriously from the Director of the FBI for the first time. I know you have a guest on later, former Justice Department person, Monica Bicker from Facebook. And it reminds me of the terrorist threat that we were facing. You know, our openness began to be exploited by terrorists. The same way that terrorists, Al-Qaeda, used aviation, which has done so much good and connected us around the world, and they turned it into a weapon that caused thousands of deaths, we started to watch terrorist groups, my last 2 years running the National Security Division, exploit social media in order to get their adherents to kill. And it was working inside the United States. There's one chilling case that I talk about that still I think people haven't heard about, of a case that looks from the perspective of a company like someone stealing customer information, names, addresses, the type of day-in, day-out thing that you were talking about earlier. However, in this case, he wasn't doing it to make $500, although he did ask for $500. He also, through Bitcoin, on the back end, had become friends with one of the most notorious terrorists in the world, a British-born citizen named Junaid Hussein. He became friends with him only through Twitter, only online. And what he did with that stolen customer information that was provided to him was turn it into a kill list that said, using this customer information located from his safe hole in Raqqa, Syria, he bombarded back to the United States through social media a list of the stolen customer information and said, kill these people by name, by address, where they live. That's the new era of national security that we're in, where criminal threats merge or blend with terrorist and national security threats, and companies, the private sector, is on the front lines for the first time.
Michelle emailed, as a person of a certain age, I recall a world that functioned before the digital age. Our total reliance on digital information is making us less safe. We're trading safety for convenience. I wonder, John, if Michelle has a point. There used to be a time when you had to actually go to the bank to rob it, and now you don't.
Michelle definitely, in fact, one of the cases we talk about is an internet bank heist where hackers managed to send human operatives to ATM machines all across the world in different countries, and they used a hack to simultaneously allow them to withdraw money from ATMs. I think Michelle does have a point. You know, for 25 years, we moved almost everything we value from analog space, from books and papers, to digital space, and connected it using a protocol, the internet's protocol, that was fundamentally never designed with security in mind. Huge advantages to that, economic convenience. However, we did so systematically, and this was true in government along with the private sector, without taking into account risk, without taking into account that the bad guys, the terrorists, the rogue nation states, the crooks, are going to move into that space. We're just starting to reckon with that now, and it's vitally important we get it right because we're about to have another revolution towards the Internet of Things. Now it won't be our books and papers, right? It'll be literally, and this is something that actually happened, it'll be the pacemakers in our hearts are digitally connected. They already rolled them out and then realized, oops, we put them in people's hearts but didn't realize that they need to be encrypted. Otherwise, an 11-year-old can hack and kill. We do not want pacemakers or the cars on our streets or the drones in the skies to be like our Microsoft Windows, where if you don't have the right patch, it stops working.
Well, back up to the 11-year-old who can make, you know, my granddad's pacemaker stop. I mean, do we need to be, how do we need to talk about these threats in a more specific way? I mean, the threat from cyber terror came up during the presidential debates. I think several of us remember this moment between Hillary Clinton and then candidate Donald Trump talking about the threat from hackers.
We need to make it very clear, whether it's Russia, China, Iran, or anybody else, the United States has much greater capacity. And we are not going to sit idly by and permit state actors to go after our information.
I don't think anybody knows it was Russia that broke into the DNC. She's saying Russia, 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 but I don't, maybe it was. I mean, it could be Russia, but it could also be China. It could also be lots of other people. It also could be somebody sitting on their bed that weighs 400 pounds, okay?
One of the moments from the 2016 presidential debates. Now, of course, that lacks a fair amount of nuance, and part of what you're describing is that they could both be partly correct. It could be somebody, you know, who is originally from Russia, who's working for China, who's now sitting on his bed in New Jersey and weighs 400 pounds. It's just complicated. Can we clarify exactly who the enemy is? Like, who are we defending ourselves from?
Boy, that exchange is one of the reasons I wrote this book, is because I've seen that so many people think that because it happens via the internet, via a hack, that you can't figure out who did it. And what we show here is case after case where painstaking work by FBI agents, by intelligence analysts, has not only figured out who did it, it's by name with the specific details of exactly how they did it. And this administration has continued that approach. We've seen some cases that have gotten lost in the shuffle of coverage about what divides us as Americans that I think shows us what unites us. There was a great case just brought by my former division at the Justice Department a week and a half ago, roughly, that laid out in detail how Russian intelligence agents broke in to the anti-doping agencies. I mean, they're such bad world players right now. They're attacking the Olympics, sports, things that should unite us all. And they were doing things like hacking into the wireless at hotels so they could steal doping information and then put fake information in to try to embarrass other athletes to hide the fact that they were doping. They also hacked into, same case laid out by the Justice Department, they hacked into the agency that was investigating their poisoning of that ended up hitting innocent civilians in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, yeah.
So we can figure out, and they said by name who did it in that case. So you can figure it out. It's not true that we can't get to the person behind the keyboard, and we need to start doing it more.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Let me get to some of your comments as we continue with John Carlin. Cine Nomine writes, China, Russia, and all the other bad actors are playing offense, and we're only ever playing defense. Of course the bad guys are going to hurt us from time to time if we only ever try to stop them. Maybe the best defense is a good offense. Look how effective the Israeli cyber attack on Iran's nuclear program was. And a listener wrote on our website, the1a.org, if only there were some way we could make this financially painful for Cold War bad actors, maybe through sanctions or trade tariff policy. John, if we know who the bad actors are, why don't we take the fight to them? Or are we, and we just don't know about it as the average American?
I'd say we're just beginning to. And one of the trends, it was as early as, so when I was at FBI, prior to that, I'd been a criminal prosecutor. When I was on the criminal side of the house, I never knew what those intel guys were doing. Occasionally an FBI agent I was working with would switch squads and they disappeared, never to be seen again behind a secure compartmented door. When I went over to be chief of staff to Bob Mueller, the door opened, and for the first time I saw the amazing work the intel community had done at figuring it out exactly who was doing what. The problem was we were keeping it all secret. So it wasn't until 2014 we brought the first case against members of the People's Liberation Army that showed by name, by address, made public what they were doing to companies day in, day out, and particular companies, and exactly what they did and stole. That approach literally just started in 2014. It was only in the last year or two that we're starting to regularly see it applied against nation state. But the criminal justice system won't do it alone. And to your guest comments, I think that's exactly right. What we need to start getting better at, say with NotPetya, is doing simultaneous responses where our allies, Australia, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, countries throughout the world, simultaneously say, hey, we're going to sanction you. We're going to throw out your people out of your embassy. We are going to raise the cost until the behavior changes. And yes, that may include sometimes cyber operations.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is what is your final criterion? What's the big factor for when the United States should go on offense? Sanctions have their own weight, but at what point should we shut Moscow's central power plant down?
Well, I think we need to calibrate our response. So just because we are weaker and we're more vulnerable in digital space than most of our adversaries. You know, when we had the Sony, the North Korean attack on Sony, the entire country of North Korea probably has fewer IP addresses than NPR. So knocking them offline is not going to be an effective response. They're attacking us where we're weak.
And I'm sorry, I just want to make sure we're clear for people who don't know how the web works. Your IP address is kind of like your computer's address online. It's how we know where to send the data you requested.
Exactly. You know, bottom line is not to get lost in the details. They don't do a whole lot online.
Gotcha.
They're not dependent digitally. We are. And so when you're thinking about how to attack back, we need to attack them where we're strongest, and it'll cause the most harm to them. And that may not be cyber. So our response policy has to be, if you hit us through cyber, we're going to hit you back, and we're going to hit you back so it hurts, so it causes equal or greater damage.
Before we let you go, John, I wonder what you see as the balance between what we have to trust government to do and what we as consumers can do. I mean, I take your point on passwords. You know, there are programs like Dashlane and LastPass that will collect all your passwords for you, let you know if you've got duplicates, help you generate super complicated passwords, keep them with you. They move from device to device. There are easy things we can do, but what's the balance, briefly, in what we have to trust government to do and what we as consumers should be doing ourselves?
Look, as consumers, every consumer, we should try to educate ourselves so we do the basic blocking and tackling of trying to be safe. including not, you know, clicking on things we don't know, changing passwords. There are other steps. The most important thing, though, I think we can do as consumers, as the public, is learn about these broader issues and demand action from our elected officials so that as we're designing this Internet of Things, as we're putting in new standards, we set good rules of the road so the technology is safe.
John Carlin, the author of Dawn of the Code War, America's Battle Against Russia, China, and the Rising Global Cyber Threat. John, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
If you are Facebook, your business is not just subject to covert attacks. The platform itself is often exploited by those seeking to recruit terrorists around the world. We'll meet one of those at Facebook who is taking on the terrorists and the hackers in just a moment. Stay close.